Judges chapter 8. Now the Ephraimites asked Gideon, "Why have you treated us like this? Why didn't you call us out when you went to fight Midian?" And they criticized him sharply. But he answered them, "What have I accomplished compared to you? Aren't the gleanings of Ephraim's grapes better than the full grape harvest of Ebiezer?" God gave them Oreb and Zeeb, the Midianite leaders, into your hands. What was I able to do compared to you? At this, their resentment against him subsided. Gideon and his 300 men, exhausted, yet keeping up the pursuit, came to Yarden and crossed it. He said to the men of Succoth, "Give my troops some bread. They are worn out, and I am still pursuing Zebah and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." But the officials of Succoth said, "Do you already have the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna in your possession? Why should we give bread to your troops?" Then Gideon replied, "Just for that, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, I will tear your flesh with desert thorns and briars." From there, he went up to Peniel and made the same request of them, but they answered the same as the men of Succoth had. So he said to the men of Peniel, "When I return in triumph, I will tear down this tower." Now Zebah and Zalmunna were in Karkor with a force of about 15,000 men, all that were left of the armies of the eastern peoples. 120,000 swordsmen had fallen. Gideon went up by the route of the nomads east of Nobah and Yogabah and fell upon the unsuspecting army. Zebah and Zalmunna, the two kings of Midian, fled, but he pursued them and captured them, routing their entire army. Gideon, son of Joash, then returned from the battle of the pass of Heres. He caught a young man of Succoth and questioned him, and the young man wrote down for him the names of the 77 officials of Succoth, the elders of the town. Then Gideon came and said to the men of Succoth, "Here are Zebah and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me by saying, 'Do you already have the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna in your possession? Why should we give bread to your exhausted men?'" He took the elders of the town and taught the men of Succoth a lesson by punishing them with desert thorns and briars. He also pulled down the tower of Peniel and killed the men of the town. Then he asked Zebah and Zalmunna, "What kind of men did you kill at Tabor?" "Men like you," they answered, each one with the bearing of a prince. Gideon replied, "Those were my brothers, the sons of my own mother. As surely as the Lord lives, if you had spared their lives, I would not kill you." Turning to Yeter, his oldest son, he said, "Kill them." But Yeter did not draw a sword because he was only a boy and was afraid. Zebah and Zalmunna said, "Come, do it yourself. As is the man, so is his strength." So Gideon stepped forward and killed them and took the ornaments off their camels' necks. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you have saved us out of the hand of Midian." But Gideon told them, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." And he said, "I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from the share of the plunder." It was the custom of the Ishmaelites to wear gold earrings. They answered, "We'll be glad to give them." So they spread out a garment, and each man threw a ring from his plunder into it. The weight of the gold rings he asked for came to 1,700 shekels. not counting the ornaments, the pendants, and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, or the chains that were around their camels' necks. Gideon made the gold into an ephod, and which he placed in Ophrah, his town. All Israel prostituted themselves by worshiping it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. Thus Midian was subdued before the Israelites and did not raise its head again. During Gideon's lifetime, the land enjoyed peace 40 years. Yerubbaal, son of Joash, went back home to live. He had 70 sons of his town of his own, for he had many wives. His concubine, who lived in Shechem, also bore him a son, whom he named Abimelech. Gideon, son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abiezerites. No sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals. They set up Baal Berit in the town of their god and did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. They also failed to show kindness to the family of Yerubbaal, that is, Gideon, for all the good things he had done for them.
Forbina, are there any questions or comments about Judges? Yes, Ellie.
My translation in verse 21 and in verse 26 says, in 21, it says, so Gideon arose and killed Zebah and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camels' necks. And then down in 26, it says there were 1,700 shekels of gold besides the crescent ornaments.
Correct.
And from what I've understood, that is one of the first places where
the crescent moon is discussed.
The crescent moon is discussed with in recordings with the enemy of Israel.
I thought it was discussed in Genesis once, but I don't recall for sure. I could be wrong though. It's a Midian. Or maybe it was Moses' father-in-law or something. It's somewhere it shows up again. It's a Midian heritage thing, which of course is worship of Ishmael or Ishmael's not worship of Ishmael, Ishmael's descendants worshiping the moon god. Any other comments?
Would that be an ungodly thing for them to keep? It's like an idol?
Depends on what you do with it. And what he did with it, it was, one could argue, be ungodly. What you could have done with it may not have been ungodly. You could have melted it down, because metal is metal. It doesn't matter what form it originally had. It matters what you use it for and what it's going to be used for in the future. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Tammy.
You start to see Gideon come into his own as a politician here.
Yes. Yeah, very true.
In verse 2, you definitely see that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Gideon, the lessons which Gideon used in the first couple of verses with regards to diffusing Ephraim's wrath, you would hope that other judges would learn from that, but they didn't. Jephthah did not. He took the other approach, which is, oh yeah, bring it on, which is the other perspective, which is not probably the best choice. At this point, yeah, Gideon starts off when Ephraim gets upset with them for not being part of the initial battle, which was supposed to be the more important thing. It's a whole Proverbs, gentle reply turns away wrath. He applied gently, stroked their ego a little bit. They're like, oh, okay, now I don't feel so bad. Yes, flattery. Now, did Gideon's men at this point actually do battle? No, actually they didn't. So technically, he's right. Ephraim's going to actually kill soldiers. Gideon didn't do it at all. The soldiers killed themselves thanks to God's hand. They just stood there and they watched, which... one could be, yeah, it's not quite as glamorous. You can't say, oh yes, I was out there, I killed umpteen guys, ah, I'm so great. That wasn't the case with his 300 men. They didn't do that. Now, he kills later on. His Suleiman actually attack the balance of the army. But at this point, he really didn't do anything. They watched. They made them, or God made them kill each other. But Ephraim actually did real battle and actually killed people. So it's kind of massaging a little bit. Hey, look what you guys actually did is more impressive than had you been with us. And they kind of, oh yes, thank you for stroking our ego. I appreciate that. Now you can finish off the battle and we're going to go home. You notice who crossed and followed Gideon's men? The 300 men? Or the Gideon? Only 300 men crossed and followed him, the original 300. What about Ephraim, who was just complaining that they didn't get to go to battle? They stayed home. They went home. Though the odds were so much greater now, they could have probably overwhelmed the army. They didn't. They stayed home. It's what's that? The strength is only paper thin. It depends on your perspective. So yes, he has come into a politician as far as making sure and being very careful at whose feelings get hurt. His comments regarding the wine, the vintner's simile. The gleanings being greater than the actual original harvest of Abazir, his father's household, or not his father, but his line's household. It's the principle of which God had blessed all of Israel. You are going to be harvesting from vines you didn't plant. You'll be harvesting crops that you didn't plant. You didn't take care of any of these. You didn't plant these trees, but I'm giving them to you in this new land. How much better that is, as opposed to I'm giving you a barren land and you have to work from scratch all the way up. It's a lot harder, a lot more work to work from scratch all the way up than it is to just walk in and take what's already there. So he's using the simile, pointing out that yours is so much better, Ephraim, because you get to come in and you don't have to do the work, but you get to reap one of the best things on the vine, which is usually the sweeter grapes are left because they've been left there for a few days longer than the rest of the grapes which have already been harvested. So they get to take what they didn't have to work for. It's a great simile. Now, of course, the simile shows up again, a metaphor actually, in a form of a metaphor, in Gideon's son, when he prophesies in the next chapter. But that's using the vine, because Gideon is called the vine. That's his symbol, is a grapevine. Not each judge. Some of the judges have symbols. Deborah is a fig tree, Gideon's a grapevine, and I forgot what some of the others were. That's standard Jewish and Christian tradition. They're walk step and step on those particular symbols regarding this story. So he uses that, points out, Ephraim, you had a great, wonderful opportunity here. You got to reap all the benefits. These guys were already running away. They lost most of their forces. They were demoralized when you showed up and surprised them. You didn't have to work that hard. God just delivered them to your hand. You see how much better you are. Strokes your ego. They're happy. Ephraim continues on and goes home. None of the tribes, of course, followed him off. Now, the poor, I can say poor. I don't have too much sympathy for them. But I should say the sad tribe of Gad. They're a disappointment at this point in their history. They don't always stay a disappointment, but they are right now. I have my little map here. Ta-da! It is... Thank you. you notice... I don't know if you can tell it that well, but I kind of moved and showed the eastern side of Israel and the east side of the Jordan, so the west side where the coastline is, I kind of lopped off because it's not part of the story here today. Because most of the action takes place in Gad's territory. Alright, now, 2 weeks ago, this is jog your memory a little bit, Gideon's forces, they sort of chased the Midianite and a few of the other armies that were with them. There were more than just them. Amalek was there. There's other kings, other armies of the east were there. Traveled down the Jordan River, crossed, and took off, heading east. Now, Ephraim was called up to, hey, stop the crossing, catch the crossing, which is approximately where I just scratched my little finger at. This little tiny area, which I just covered in black. That's approximately the area of the crossing, which is easy to cross. It's where the Jabbok River, the Jordan River, and a couple of cliffs and whatnot are easily, the water's not very deep, it's quick to cross, that's the crossing. Ephraim's told to capture it. Because all of Manasseh's people weren't available, Ephraim's guys were. So I would have gotten rid of them earlier, anyway. But so Ephraim captures it, kills the two guys, the two leaders, the generals, dispatches the rest of the battle, the army that was with them. Where were the two kings, though, through this whole battle? They fled also. They were originally way up here where the Jezreel Valley is, where the battles first took place, along with the two other generals that were there. They left. They followed the same route. However, they got across the river before Ephraim was there. They got across with a few soldiers that made it across. Ephraim took out the ones that were there because, keep in mind, how long does it take to travel from the Jezreel Valley down to this crossing if you're running? This is long distance. But you probably take you maybe a day for an army to get there if they're fleeing. Well, how long does it take to get a message from the Jezreel Valley down to Ephraim saying, must your troops now go over here and capture the territory?
My horse.
It doesn't matter how it's going to take. It's going to take a whole lot longer than it takes the army who's already running there to capture it. So some of them are going to make it there before Ephraim is ready to battle and then cross, which a percentage of them did. Where'd they go? Says the two kings' names, which I forgot their name off the top of my head, so it's these. Zabah and Zalmunah. They travel to Karkor, which is this little red dot here. It's debatable where it's actually located, but they figure it's about 6 miles or so west to northwest of modern-day, the city of Ammon, the modern-day Jordan capital. Ammon, I have this little triangle thing. It doesn't exist at this point in the history, but I put it there for reference to tell you about where it was at. So Karkor is about this little, it's a small plain here. Who owns this territory? Gad owns it. Now you have I have a little red line. See, there's Edom down here with little red dots. That's approximately where Edom's borders begin. Moab's borders are here, this little big red dot splattery section. And Ammon's kind of off the page, but they're in that area. Midian is a little further this way, out here. But it was Midian along with other kings of the east. It wasn't just Midian alone. So they probably, though it doesn't explicitly state so, they probably mustered probably a few kings from Ammon as well to assist them. That's probably why they were able to cross the area and hang out and dwell in this region without too much problem. Otherwise, you start crossing other kings' territories to get a little upset if you don't tell them ahead of time. So Ammon may or may not have been with them. Doesn't really make much difference. They're here.
Which tribe is Gideon from?
Which tribe? He is from Manasseh.
The other half the tribe.
The weaker side. By the way, I did find one guy who argues that Ophrah, his town, is right here in Manasseh's little corner. I believe 2 weeks ago I told that there were so many different disputes as to where it was located at, and all of them located it in Ephraim proper. Well, there's one guy that said actually there's a small little area that is right next to Mount Ephraim or nearby that's in Manasseh's territory, which would make these make more sense as to where it would be located. He's probably lived somewhere along this little spot in this area. I have Shechem written here too. That shows up next week or 2 weeks from now. They are in Karkor. Now you have just lost 120,000 of your soldiers. You got 15,000 left. You went fleeing. Now you're regathering your troops again, and you're getting ready for battle, or at least ready to defend yourself at this point. Where do you think your enemy's coming from?
Same way you just came?
Same way you just came, because they're behind you, right? National tendency. Karkor is here, this little big red dot. They came from the Jezreel Valley. Now we're starting to Gideon crosses over to Sukkot. We'll discuss Sukkot and Peniel's reactions in a minute. Goes over to Sukkot, asks for supplies, they reject. Crosses over to Peniel, asks for supplies, they reject. Goes all the way down here to Jogbecha and Nebo, which are south and east. The exact opposite direction these 15,000 guys are facing. So when they're looking with their, not with binoculars, but imagine they did, they're looking with their spies, and their spies are sitting out here saying, hey, do I see anybody coming? No. Oh, okay. That's because they're all behind you. And they didn't know it. See, Gideon, though I mentioned before that Ephraim opted not to follow, it was a good thing they didn't. It's a little difficult to hide thousands of soldiers while they're running across the battlefield or anywhere else for that matter. It's a whole lot easier to hide 300 men. So you can easily sneak all the way around, get behind without being noticed, which is precisely what they did. They came from behind. This is where they actually get into engage in battle. They fought. Now, because as a king, you are usually the furthest distance from the battle, the perceived battle. Where do you think the kings were located when they were at these 15,000 men soldiers that were left?
In the rear.
Probably in the rear. Right where Gideon and all of his men were. Hence, easy to capture. Not say that it wasn't all at work. I'm not poo-pooing his effort. It was fantastic. But the point is, he was able to get them quickly without having to go through all the soldiers to do it. Catch them ahead of time, a lot of soldiers' kind of morale dissipates really quickly. So, that's what he did. Grabs Karkor, or grabs Zalmano and Zeba. Thank you. I keep forgetting the guy's name. Grabs it from this backside, wipes all the rest of the army, and balances 300 men. Their history. As far as we know, we don't know if Gideon lost any men. We don't know. It doesn't say. I'm willing to bet, because God was on his side and it doesn't specify, he probably didn't lose any. Surprise attack from the rear when the guys are already petrified of you. They already turned on each other earlier. Who's sitting and turning on each other again? So there's a chance he didn't lose any men at all coming from the rear. So he came, takes them, goes back to Penuel and Sukkot. Now let's go back a little bit. Now I just gave you a rundown of what you just read. Verse 5, Sukkot and Penuel. You can Penuel, however you pronounce it, doesn't make much difference. It's the same town. This town has a little bit of history. This town is where Jacob wrestled with the angel. He named it Penuel. You recall that or not, when he was debating, when he was saying, all right, God, how do I deal with this with Esau? And God sends an angel down, because you have struggled with both man and God, and you have prevailed. And then Jacob called the place Penuel, which is face. I have faced God. I faced God face to face, not died. The Jabbok River is what he was crossing at that time. Because where is Esau? Well, he's down here toward the south, which is where he's traveling to at that point in time in Jacob's history. Jacob obviously does not go all the way to Esau's territory. Once they meet, exchange some pleasantries, he takes off and goes back to Sukkot. Dwells there temporarily, then of course they settle in Shechem area, Shechem territory. So Jacob started or established the city by naming it. He put a monument there. He named it Penuel. This is where it is. If you have a good tradition, or a strong tradition. Gideon comes to Sukkot. Now you have to put yourself in perspective with the people of Sukkot at this time, just for a minute. You have been oppressed by the Midianite people for years. You have been living, just like Gideon's family, in caves and struggling to survive. You don't have much to spare regarding food, because Midian takes and destroys and takes and kills whatever they can get a hold of regarding food. You don't have a lot of supplies to give to anybody. Same thing with Penuel. They've been oppressed as well. They don't have much to give to anybody. However, which I think is probably one of an additional reason as to why Ephraim's men did not follow. We're only talking about 300 men. They're not asking for a room and board. They're asking for bread, which is easy to make when it's unleavened bread. And it sits in the stomach and it stays there. That's all they're asking for. It doesn't take a lot, but they rejected it. Now, Sukkot, I don't know the area that well. I saw some photos online a few weeks ago. You know the thorns and briars it says I will come back and thrash you with? Well, if you look at the territory of where this city is located at, guess what grows around there? Thorns and briars. It's a miserable place. There's not a whole lot. That's why it's near a river, because it's the only source of nourishment they've got. The symbol of thorns and briars, though, I find it interesting, because I thought this was a cool little thing that one of the commentaries said. thorn and briar gives you pain, but produces nothing. They cannot give you any nourishment. They cannot give you any food, which is precisely what Sukkot did. They gave Gideon's men pain by allowing them not to eat, but go on. They provided no nourishment nor food. Thus, they'll be repaid equally with pain. No nourishment, no food. In the fact that they were... Granted, the Bible says they ripped their flesh with the thorns. Some argue it actually was more of a shoving onto a bed of thorns. It doesn't make much difference. The point is, these 70 men were in great agony when being cut apart by thorns, which, of course, produces pain, no nourishment, and there's no benefit whatsoever. I happen to like the symbol because Abimelech, Gideon's son, runs across the same symbol later on in the prophecy. Produced pain, but nothing good came from it. Which is the opposite of Gideon's, which is the vine, which produces good fruit, no pain. I mean, there are no thorns to grapes. Well, there might be some variety out there that has some kind of a thorn on it, but best of my knowledge, there's no thorns to grapes. So it's a good contrast. I like that contrast. What was Penuel's issue? The town, Penuel, how you wish to pronounce it.
But they refused the same thing, but they were killed.
They were killed, weren't they?
Killed them.
Yeah, see, you notice that Gideon threatened Sukkot's men. They all come back with thorns and briars. He told Penuel's guys, I'm going to take the tower down. Now, when he actually came back, he does precisely what he said to Sukkot. He didn't kill them in a Sukkot. He just injured them, probably permanently. But the men of Penuel, he killed. Well, why is that? What happened?
He was really hungry.
It has a bit to do with Penuel and what they trusted in. See, Penuel, they had this wonderful defensive tower, didn't they? Right? That's what they said. We had this one tower. We're going to take this tower down, your main defense. So Penuel's men, they have their, however many men they have, it sound to make a difference. They have some men of the city. They have a choice. They can assist these 300 soldiers, not much soldiers yet, but 300 men, and say, all right, yeah, we'll help you fight this battle against these two. But instead, they trusted in their tower, their defensive tower, didn't they? Because this really wasn't their fight, as far as their perspective was. Hey, you don't have these two kings that are oppressing all of us. You go fight them. You can live or die. It's only 300 guys. They know there's 15,000 guys out there. They see the fact that this is a pathetic battle. They're never going to win. They're trusting in their own little tower. If one trusts in such a structure, and then that structure comes on attack, what are you going to do? You're going to fight back, aren't you, with your nice little structure? The thing is, most Jewish commentators, and I believe three Christians said the same thing, that... But the Penuel's men didn't have to die. They all went into the tower to defend their city against Gideon. He wiped out the tower, and everybody inside, all the soldiers, are dead in the process because they fought. They tried to defend their city from Gideon. And so, okay, you can defend it after he has 300 guys that have now just wiped out your town. The city, at least the males of the town. Not children, we're not discussing children or women, just the men. They're all the tribe of Gad. See, you see the disappointment in Gad and what they came to at this point. They had the opportunity to follow precisely what God was doing. See, God at this point was giving them the chance to, hey, I am now freeing you. Follow. Do as Gideon is telling them. Come on, we're trying to do this, which is the right thing to do. You know equally as I do. Midian's been oppressing you just like they oppress us. So let's fight against them. Help me by feeding my men. It's not a major task that he's asking for. It's a small one. They opted not to. Though the odds were easy for them, all they had to do was supply food. Not military men, not supplies, just food. It wasn't a lot of food. Just talking about bread. They opted not to. It is a disgrace. How many of us would have done the same? Like, wait a minute. We can see, if you can see, which maybe they couldn't, but if you can see, all right, God has delivered a 135,000 man army into these 300 soldiers, and they effectively wiped out 120,000 of those men without losing a single soldier.
Yeah.
That smacks of hand of God. It does. I mean, the odds are pathetic in comparison, and yet it's so obvious there was the hand of God that did this. And you have Penuel and Sukkoth, which see that too. They saw these men come through. They saw the battle that Ephraim just took place, which is a short distance. They can actually see it from where their city boundaries are. They saw what they did to the wolf and the raven, the two generals. They saw that the battle took place. They saw what happened. They see the hand of God's here. And these people are supposed to be believers. Believe in God. Believe in the God of Israel. And they said no. It's just it's a great disappointment. Now, I'm not faulting all the tribe of Gad. Don't get me wrong. Just the two most crucial points at this moment in time. The two most important cities, which Gideon repaid them for what was spared.
Well, that makes sense. The men of Penuel that died,
they were fighting back.
Their penalty from Gideon.
Yes. Which makes sense now as to why Gideon had to go beyond what he actually originally said.
Mm-hmm.
He said just to take the terror down. He actually had to wipe the men out, too. Let's see here. The young man. You know, it's Gideon comes back, of course, when he's asking, he's inquiring, all right, who are the people in charge of Sukkot? He inquires a young man. The young have a tendency to have loose lips, but still know who's in charge. This isn't the first time it's been used. Joshua did the same thing when he took Luz. Gideon does it here. I believe it happens one more time. The young know enough about who's what power is, but don't know enough to keep your mouth shut. So he grabs a young man who is also most likely Israelite from Gad. He's most likely from the tribe of Gad. He, of course, rattles off who the 70-some-odd elders are. Punishes them accordingly, which I thought that was kind of funny because it's apparently commonly used. The young are treated as, yeah, you know what you know, but you're too foolish to keep your mouth shut. It's kind of cute. I find it comical. Let's see here. Anything else I want to say about that section? Okay, let's continue on to when he starts to go back. One thing I want to point out before I continue on too much further here. Gideon makes it a point to punish both Sukkot and Penuel before he punishes the two kings. You notice that?
Mm-hmm.
That the point is he comes back at midday, broad day, which is great at this point in time because normally they have to hide during the day and come out at night because the Midianites would have killed them. He's able to come back. He's free. Comes back with his 300 men. We assume he has still all 300. He punishes Sukkot and Penuel. He has both Zibo and whatever the guy's name is in possession. They're both still alive. He doesn't kill the kings yet. Makes the point to exact a punishment upon Sukkot and Penuel first. Because theirs was more grievous at that moment in time. The kings were already captured. They were going to die anyway. That wasn't a big deal. That was taken care of. But at this point, the people of Sukkot and Penuel needed to see how important what they did, how significant it was.
Well, not only that, but proof that he...
Proof, oh, that's true. They needed proof as well.
Well,
he could have brought the two dead kings as well. We accomplished the same thing, exactly. But he brought them both alive. And those kings saw it, too. They saw, holy cow, this guy is going to obliterate two of his own towns as far as they're concerned. He wipes out one and mangles the other one. Before he even kills us, who he hates, who he fought against. Yes, Ellie.
There's a difference between bringing two dead people back that you didn't see how they died and watching an execution.
That's true. There is a difference. There is. That's one of the reasons why executions used to be public, as opposed to just people that told that so-and-so died. And that may be a big fact that he wished to have. And we don't know where he executed the kings at, by the way. We don't know if they were executed in Sukkot, Penuel, or some other area. It doesn't make much difference. But it's somewhat interesting that he punished both the Gad's territory, or Gad's cities, before he wiped out the Midianite kings. And it's important to know. It was because it was such a significant issue that Sukkot and Penuel did. All they had to supply was bread. It didn't have to be even good bread. They just needed nourishment from running. His 300 men had to run too, by the way, from the Jezreel Valley all the way down the Jordan to try to catch up with these few soldiers. They're tired too. It's a lot of work to travel that distance. As far as I know, I think it's somewhere around about 40 miles, something like that. It's a large traveling distance to do that with 300 guys. And we don't know if they had soldiers, horses. As far as we know, they didn't, because they don't mention them. So presumably it's on foot or a boat. Once you reach the Jordan, they may have traveled boat. I don't really know. But they were hungry. It was a simple task to provide food, but they didn't take it. So he comes back, of course, he wipes the two towns. The kings are left. And this, I'm not quite sure what to think of this in verse 18. Adad breaks down the tower of Penuel and kills the men of the city. He says to Zeba and Zalmunna, "What sort of men did you kill in Tabor?" I'm going to stop there for a second. Tabor is a mountain. It's a mountain west of Galilee. I have my little map up here. It's in Zebulun's territory. It's near the Jezreel Valley. "What sort of men did you kill?" And they said, this is my translation, by the way. "Your appearance is like theirs, identical, like the form of the king's sons." Verse 19, Gideon replies, "They were my brothers, the son of my mother. As the Lord lives, had you let them live, I would not kill you." I'm going to stop there for a moment. These weren't half-brothers, by the way. Because if they are the sons of your mother, that means they also have to be the sons of your father. As opposed to, they could be the sons of your father, but not necessarily your mother. So these are actually full-blooded brothers of his. This was the important people of his family who these kings had killed at Tabor. He says to Jether, hold on, back up a second here. The one thing I don't quite know what to make of, maybe you can help me on this, is when my translation says, "Your appearance is like theirs, identical, like the form of the king's sons." Does anybody else have a different translation of that? Like the form of somebody else? Like,
it said even.
What was that?
Each.
Sovereign? What was yours, Rose?
Mine says each one resembled the children of the king, of a king.
Resembling the son of a king.
Son of a king. Somebody of great leadership. Somebody have a good idea as to what that means?
It would probably depend upon their appearance and what they were wearing, and perhaps they could have been on horses, they could have had on armor, they could have had on a different dress.
Well, we know that Manasseh's territory and people have been oppressed. They don't have a whole lot regarding possessions because they've been oppressed for the past, I forgot how many years it was.
Confidence in the way they carried themselves?
That could be, because I've been stuck on that, because there is no king of Israel. It's important that we know that at this point, and Gideon rejects it. There is no king, so there was no actual king's sons. So I'm not quite sure why these two kings got that.
It resembles a son.
Resembles. What does that mean, though?
Someone in a position, I think, of royalty.
Do they just have this glow about them or something?
No, I
don't understand it, really.
His father was a very important man at one time. Remember, he went to the city, and Gideon had...
That's true. Of the area,
very important
of Ophrah, that's true. He was an important man in that town. That's true.
Right.
That's
and
true.
His father repented.
That's true.
Son.
That's true. He did. He defended his son. Maybe that's what it means. No commentator talks about it. They all avoid the sentence. So I was stuck and thought, well, how would I interpret this statement? King's sons. I was stuck that the only thing I could possibly grasp was that they were of people who somehow had authority or appeared to have authority. But I couldn't get a good answer.
Who wrote this book?
Granted,
those terms too.
That's true. Who wrote the book? Well, we know that Samuel put it together. That may have been an influential factor.
Yeah.
But maybe they fought like gentlemen instead of barbarians. That could be too.
That's possible. We don't know if they actually fought.
Well,
yes.
If they were. I was thinking more if it could have been that that they had like a clear, if you are in a position of authority, you have a clear like path of judgment, right and wrong. You have
leadership
to it.
Right,
and you're
right.
able to actually say, you know, you shouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's, I mean, because that's a role of the leaders.
Position of authority.
Well, see,
yeah
and that might, that may kind of make sense. Hold on a second, Tammy. We know that in Gideon's father and his whole household, all his brothers assuming as well, all were idol worshippers. And we don't know when they killed his brothers in Tabor. It doesn't say when it happened.
They were idol worshippers?
Gideon's whole family were idol worshippers in the very beginning of his story. God selects Gideon and says, fix this. And so Gideon at night takes 10 of his assistants, rips down the idol altar, builds another one, and takes the carved image and burns that as its wood. And that... And then, of course, is when it turns his father around. We don't know when his brothers were killed. We don't know much about that. Yes, Tammy, you had your hand up a minute ago.
There's a word for this. Charisma.
Charisma. Ah. That could be. They could be just charismatic individuals that distinguish themselves accordingly.
You know, it doesn't matter. You could be wearing rags, but if you have some air about you, the rags, you don't see the rags.
That's a good point.
Referred, charisma doesn't explain being referred to as a king.
Denotes
authority and or leadership.
So sons of the king.
Sons of the king, right. They didn't have as, right.
You know,
heir. It could be, though, because actually Gideon was pretty audacious to do what he did with the idol, too.
That's true.
He did it during the night, but everybody knew who it was when
right.
they woke up. So you put audacity with charisma, and you've got kind of like an arrogant kind of thinker. And
which,
and if all the men were kind of like that,
be that way.
If all the men of his family had that about them, mm-hmm.
they could be. Yes.
New word, King Charisma.
King Charisma. Aura of kingship. Yes.
And I think it's possible that maybe they were flattering him in hopes that he would not kill them.
That could be. That's a good point, because kingship in the pagan society might be enough to entice someone to say, oh, well, thank you. Instead of killing you, you are now my slaves, which could be the alternative point of view. Yes, Bill.
Did he have a throne that he had?
Gideon at this point did not have a throne.
Okay, well, it says here, as thou art, so were they. If he didn't have a throne, he was still known as
a... He was a warrior at this point.
Yeah. So as thou art.
As thou art, yes, so were they. Right.
Each one resembled the children of a king.
Which
he might not have been.
It could, but he didn't have a crown on his head, right? He didn't have any kind of kingship type of role other than exacting punishment, which he obviously did with Sukkot and Penuel, which of anybody else's territory, if somebody did that and took two of Midian's towns out and said, hey, I'm going to wipe this town out, that person just became king by doing so. Because you were able to exact punishment and oppress two other cities. Yes, Ellie. I'm going to leave this subject matter after this comment because I want to continue on.
Israel were not nomadic people, and they were very prosperous people. And the other men that they killed looked like Gideon. To me, they would have had similar dress, and they were prosperous people. They didn't look like
commoner type of thing.
The people who lived in that area.
That could be.
So, because he said they looked like you, he would have been dressed like them.
Very well could be. All right, we're going to go ahead and leave the subject matter. But just want to throw it out there because it's an interesting comment to have, to comment. It could be simple flattery. That could be bottom line what it is. I don't know. But it was interesting. It caught my attention. No other comments? All right. Oh, yes?
I was just going to say, verse 21 kind of gives it away for me. When the king said, as a man is, so is his strength.
Right.
So maybe they did not appear, maybe they were not a fighting people, so to speak, and that's why they were able to slay them.
You as far as able to slay his brothers?
Yes.
That's possible. I'll think about that one for a while.
I thought they were referring to that follows verse 20. They were referring to
Gideon. Yeah, Gideon and his son. That's how I would normally Well, I'll think about that. It was an interesting comment. I'm going to move on and finish this thing off because I'm almost over time. Okay, so he says to his son, where is it? Here, so, verse 20. To Jether, his firstborn, arise and kill them. But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, since he was still a youth. Bottom line, kid was too young. You could argue that, well, so why would Gideon have him do this? Why would even Gideon ask?
Yeah.
Well, because his son has the potential to be a judge, which what Gideon is just now became, a judge of Israel. And his sons assist him in that judgment. He has 70 of them, as we learned. We already learned 70 sons. Not the same woman. Not look on your face. It's not the same woman. It's 70 sons from various wives/concubine grouping going on there. But so they all become judges, meaning they travel to and fro throughout all of Israel and assisting people when they have issues and problems. That's their task. That's what judges do. There are a lot of judges of Israel that use that technique. They all become judges. Many judges, exactly. District judges and whatnot. So his son, Elson, you have the ability, you must learn what it means to be a judge. And what does a judge have to do? Sometimes has to actually carry out a sentence. Yes, Jeff.
Could just be the ultimate insult.
Having the man's son kill you.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, David against Goliath. You know, Goliath, what do you send a little, you know,
little child to do this?
A dog and come out with a stick?
It could be. I happen to like Ziba and Zalmunna's response. For you arise and slay us, for as a man is, so is his strength. That can be taken as like an insult. Oh, come on, you're not man enough. Stand up. Do it yourself. Or it can be taken as a pleading. You're going to have a little kid who can't wield a sword to kill me quickly. It's going to hurt. I'd rather you do it so you can wield a sword and get it over with quickly. You can take it a lot of different ways. I happen to think that's comical because you can take it either way. I mean, yeah, okay, if I'm looking at death, exactly. If I have a young boy, we don't know what he's youth usually means under the age of 20. He could have been 19. He could have been 13. He could have been 12. It makes no difference. Boy, he was younger than 20. So it could be as simple as enticing somebody stronger to do it instead. It could be something simple as that. We don't know. But I thought it was funny. The Jewish commentators point out it's because they were pleading. That they didn't want the youth killing them because it was going to hurt too much. That was their perspective. They may not be. It's humorous. It's just supposed to be comical. There's a little bit of humor in the Bible when you look at it certain ways. So they, of course, he then goes, arises, he slays them. Took the crescents, which Ali pointed out. They were on the necks of the camels. Yes, crescents, Midian is one of their gods, which, of course, is still worshipped in 90% of all of Arab countries, and a lot of other countries aren't Arab. Still worship the crescent. Still worship that god of that moon. There aren't any Muslims here, right? Give myself a shot. strike that off. The men of Israel said to Gideon, in verse 22, will rule over us. No, he didn't say reign over us. The term is actually rule. Yeah. Reign is what a king does. Rule is what a dictator does. There is a difference in Hebrew. There's a reason they use one term versus the other.
Correct.
Because Gideon has shown... Okay. Gideon has shown that he has the ability to conquer and enforce God's laws. If he has that ability, then he can rule. He can say that, hey, God said X, Y, Z, this is what's going to happen, this is what we're going to do, and he can enforce it. He's shown that ability to do so, which is what a ruler does. Rules over you. God is supposed to be the king of Israel, however, he is the ruler over the nations. There's a difference. There's a reason. He's not the king over all the nations. Judaism calls him the ruler of the nations, because he enforces his laws upon those who do not want them. A king is supposed to be elected or selected by popular desire. We wish to serve you. That's what a king is supposed to be. Now, granted, they never really are, but that's human kings. But it's supposed to be that way. So it's supposed to be the king of Israel, but the ruler of the nations. And that he, there's a one who doesn't want him as king, but now they realize, holy cow, we have to. That's the nations. Versus Israel says, please be our king. It's a different perspective, different philosophy. Rule over us. He said, you and your sons, your grandson, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. He says, I shall not rule over you. Nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. The Lord will enforce these things. Lord will king. Now, some of your sons may say king versus rule. That makes a difference. There is a difference in the Hebrew language between the two. I thought that was interesting. That's a good point. That they were asking for a dictator, and Gideon said no. He's not going to be a dictator. It's not going to happen. He'll be judged, but not a dictator. Request 24, here's Gideon's downfall. Poor guy, never had a chance. I shall make request of you. Let each man give you a nose ring. Mine says nose ring. Some of you guys says earrings. I don't know which one's right. All my Hebrew texts, all of them call it nose rings, not earrings. But all the English texts I have all say earrings. I didn't even look it up which one was which, or which one it was actually supposed to be. But either way, they're rings. Yes?
Could be both. Most times they have a chain that goes from the earring to the nose with the...
That's possible.
On.
That's possible. I didn't think about that. It could be both. That could be. Either way, it's either nose or earring, or combo. Whatever it is. Throw it down, he makes this huge, massive pile of this stuff that he selects or gathers. And they say, the weight of those nose rings that he requested was 1,700 gold dinars, how you pronounce it, aside from the crescents and the pendants that the purple wool garments worn by the kings of Midian, aside from the chains on the necks of the camel. Verse 27, Gideon made it into an ephod and hung it in his city. Which city was his?
Orpha.
Or how you pronounce it, Orpha or Web. It's this little blue dot here on the far end of my map. What's the big deal about that? What does it matter?
It had to do with God's rule.
It didn't have to do with rule.
They were only supposed to be at the temple or where the priests served?
Yes. Yes. You're getting around it, but yes, that's where I'm going here. All right. What was it? It was gold, right? Gold objects. That's what they were. Now, how was that different? He made it a monument. We'll call it a monument for the sake of argument. He made a monument in order to say, this is the wonderful thing that God did for us. See, this wonderful gift he saved us. What's different between that monument versus the monuments that Joshua did? Joshua made monuments. Yes, Tammy.
Well, one thing is that he made it into a particular shape.
Very true.
To resemble the ephod.
Ephod, exactly, the breastplate.
Which is the breastplate of the high priest, which is part of his garments that he would wear whenever he was exacting judgment, whatever judgments God called him to do.
Exactly.
And so if he had taken the gold instead and made them look like nuggets and built something, it wouldn't have been a problem.
Maybe not a problem. We'll discuss that in a second. But you're right.
But
he did something.
Anything.
He made it something in particular.
Or like what Jacob did at Penuel, where he had,
it's just rocks.
took some rocks and,
it was nothing fancy, just rocks.
Yeah.
Right.
And so he made this into something that everybody would see this thing and know what it was.
Precisely. It was. He made an ephod. He made a breastplate.
Yeah.
Which is, she pointed out, exactly correct. It is for judgment. He took a symbol out of God's temple and brought it over to Orpha. Not the actual object, but a symbol of that object. And brought it to Orpha. Now, Israel at this point has a tendency to worship idols. We know that. That's what they've been doing all along. Worshiping objects. What was that?
They're fickle.
Worship anything that exists. So, by taking a, quote, holy symbol, bringing it over to your town, which is not allowed. You're not supposed to be doing that. You are not to copy anything from that temple and bring it as your own. It's not yours. This is God's temple. You don't get to do that. Not without God's explicit permission. And so far as I know, he's never given that to anyone. Yes, Jeff.
Kind of brings up a thorny subject, but...
Go ahead.
Does it have any sort of bearing on the tablets of the Ten Commandments that
the people put on everywhere under the sun?
Most synagogues have giant versions of them. sitting up there. Well, that's obviously something that was in the
holy object inside of the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
The tablets, making it, mind you, what do we make our tablets look like? Like an M&M, like an M, or tombstones, essentially. They look like tombstones. Do the original tablets look like tombstones?
We don't know.
Who knows? Doesn't matter.
Cecil B. DeMille.
Right. Do you idolize... Yes, Cecil said yes. I admit, yes, he did. Do you idolize, or do you focus on those two objects?
No.
No. Do you focus on what's in the objects? Yes, the wording that's actually written on them. So, the key isn't, as Tammy pointed out, he could have made anything. He chose an object of the temple that's used for judgment as well as worship in other areas too, brought it outside the temple to people with a tendency to worship objects. Now, if all of us were sitting here today, many of us have those little tombstone versions of the Ten Commandments, which it's not your death, but it kind of looks like it, huh? In your home somewhere, on the wall, whatever it makes me this to this. Is any of us in this room have a tendency to worship them?
No.
No, we don't. It's that is a key factor. Tammy's comment, he could have built anything, is right. He could have built anything. It makes no difference. He could have made it look like a rock. He could make it look like a bowl. As if no one ever worships the object in any circumstances, it's not as big of an issue. He did two mistakes. He brought a symbol of an object out of the temple, thus allowing everyone to worship it, including his own family. Something he was not supposed to do. Yes, Ellie.
We do something more than the Ten Commandments.
We bring the whole menorah. Yeah, we have the menorah.
We have the menorahs, and we can have them in our homes, which a Jew looks at it and says,
that's
I don't
not right.
Do with it, right. Because it's not supposed to be here. But is it because the ephod was to answer questions?
Well, see, there's a subtle difference between a menorah and its symbolic source versus an ephod, which is the high priest only. All right.
Wow.
Who supplies the oil to a menorah?
The people.
The people of Israel, not the priests. The people of Israel. You are the light. You are the oil. You are the source of the menorah. That's what your job is. All right. What does the menorah itself symbolize? The action of Israel lights, according to Zechariah. Seven angels or spirits of God. When you light them, what are you doing? You're allowing them to see you and watch what you're doing. That's its function. That's its symbolic function. Those seven spirits of gods, that you said the seven churches, you've heard that terminology. It's the same thing. It's the exact same scenario. The spirit of this church, spirit of that church. It's the seven that the God has set up. That's its symbol. Do you worship that? No. I broke a bunch of them at home. No offense, Mom. I tried to repair them. They look terrible. Do I worship it? No. Especially now, because, man, it looks hideous. Yes, she did cry. No. I've got some funny comments from my welding instructor. I said, why are you guys throwing menorahs at each other? They come back with all these various branches broken off. No. But you don't worship it, do you? If the children of Israel did not worship or did not give any reverence whatsoever to the symbol that was made of gold, as opposed to rock, like all the other judges used to do, would it have been a big of an issue? Probably not. Probably. I can't speak for God. It's difficult. He doesn't like it when I do so. So it may have not been much of an issue had no one, including Gideon, ever considered it or looked at it as a second thought. But they didn't. They actually built a mini temple at Orphah around this ephod as well as the altar that he built. He does stand up first. Jeff.
Is that part of the reason why there were so many abominations and destructions of the temple? Is that you had people going, the temple of the Lord is like their lucky charm or something like that, instead of and completely disregarding who God is and what he actually said. They kind of saw this as their symbol in and of itself, and disregarding who it represented.
Look at the object that it was, rather than what was behind that object. That is a possibility. Yes, Ellie.
Well, also, the ephod is a symbol of, I mean, the high priest. That's And that's how questions were answered.
Mm-hmm.
That had a system. These other things have meaning, but the ephod was used.
It was
used,
a purpose. It is a tool. It's a tool.
It was a tool. And
I gotta call it quits.
Did
I'm
they
over
actually
time.
Try to use it?
I can't swear they used it. I know they used his altar that he built.
They
that Gideon used the altar. I don't know if they used it. It was a very heavy one, made of gold. But they may have. I don't know. I don't know for sure. But it wasn't a wise choice. It points out, children of Israel, they followed it, and they started. They turned into a snare. They started to worship that rather than going to temple like they're supposed to. Last comment on the subject matter. Yes.
It seems kind of like a self-elevation to me.
Glorifying oneself. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Gideon's the one that's doing it, and then the ephod is a symbol of judgment, which he
is a judge, right?
And then he puts it in his town, which he's the guy who was used with the 300 men to accomplish this. I mean, it seems like the idolatry kind of was already in his heart when he decided to do that in the first place. And then the dominoes just kind of
stacked up
from
there. Now, we discussed 2 weeks ago when God first, or two, three, whatever long ago it was, when God first selected Gideon, what was his downfall?
Right.
Before he selected him. Was Gideon an upright, godly man?
He wasn't seasoned.
No, he wasn't. He was cowardly. He was an idol worshiper. What about all the previous judges that God selected? They were righteous followers of Israel ahead of time. So Gideon himself started out in a
flawed,
yes, to put it bluntly. He had some issues against him already. So he has propensity to do things he shouldn't be doing. That's in his nature to do so. This was his downfall. He did a great with everything he did up to this point. He made a mistake he shouldn't have done. And Israel followed it quite happily.
It also goes to show you what happens when you think you have a great idea and you think, I'm going to help God out.
Yeah.
This makes all practical sense. I'll make Never, a second yeah. temple and we'll do this thing. And
yeah, exactly. It'll be great.
It's a good idea.
Exactly.
Well, it wasn't God's idea, so maybe it's not such a good idea.
God's very strict on what he accepts, what he does not accept. Note all the monuments that Joshua did. How many of them did God tell him not to do? Well, none of them. He told him to do all of them. Every monument Joshua did, God said, you will build this monument, and this is what you'll build, and this is how you'll build it. What are the other judges? They didn't put up monuments. Deborah didn't put up a monument. Ehud didn't put up a monument. Othniel did not put up a monument. None of them did. Joshua was the only one who put monuments up, and they were only rocks, unhewn, and left as is. They weren't designed to be attractive, just to remind one's self. There's a little difference. Now, the other person who put up monuments, that I think off the top of my head, is Moses put up a monument once, but the patriarchs did. They put up monuments. And what did they look like?
Rocks.
None of them. Golden calf was a slightly separate issue, but that's something that Aaron did, and I'm not going there. Not today. It was just an idol. It was straight, blunt, old-fashioned idol.
Kind of adds to the point that...
Yeah.
Don't...
They
worship the gold. Exactly. The stone, who cares if the stone looks like... It's just unhewn stone. It's just a rock.
Oh.
There's a little difference there versus something that's designed and fashioned to look like something else, especially when it's made out of gold. Okay, I'm going to end that subject matter. We're going to finish off this time over time. Let's see. Land was tranquil for 40 years. Jerubbaal, which is, of course, Gideon's other name, which is one who contends with Baal. Son of Joash went and settled his home, had 70 sons emerging from his loins, for he had many wives. Let's say how many. He had his concubine who was in Shechem. I put Shechem up here because we're going to show up with his son, Abimelech, next time, who does some really stupid things. concubine was in Shechem. He also bore a son, calls him Abimelech. Gideon, son of Joash, died. Good old age. He was buried at the grave of Joash, his father, in Ophrah of the Abizarites. it happened when Gideon died. Children once again went astray after Baalim, or the Baals. They set up Baal Berith as a god for themselves. Children of Israel did not remember Hashem, or the Lord, their God, who rescued them from the hand of the surrounding enemies. Also, they did not perform kindness to the house of Jerubbaal or Gideon. What does that mean? Not perform kindness. Yes. Jeff.
I think it was kind of funny how Gideon earlier in this chapter was saying, no, I don't want to be a king. None of my sons will be kings and everything. What does he name his son? My father is a king.
My father is a king, yes.
Yeah.
He's got issues. He's got issues. excuse me. I'm going to stop at verse 35. What does it mean to not perform kindness with the house of Jeroboam or Gideon with all the goodness he had done with Israel? It's actually, which we learn in the following chapter with Abimelech and the rest of his sons, who Abimelech kills them all off except one. Actually, technically two. He kills 68 sons because himself lives and then the young, well, anyway, the other son lives. So it says 70, but he actually kills
60. 70 plus the what?
Well, it could be. And then one illegitimate. All right, so one of the sons lived, so he only kills 69. Did not perform, or was not perform kindness. What did Gideon's sons do now that Gideon was judge? What's their function? So we talked about it a few minutes ago. They were judges as well. They go around and help and assist and judge Israel. What happens when you despise your judge? You don't obey him. You don't do anything with him. You want him gone. Penuel would despise his judge. You don't want a judge, do you? You don't want one to be ruling over you. To not perform kindness is the same thing as to ignore a judge's rule. You did not agree with it, thus... Yeah, out of disrespect. And that's precisely what the children of Israel did. They did not respect any of those judges, any of Gideon's sons, as a judge over them. Not as a national ruler. We're not talking about a ruling judge. We're talking about an individual, small scenario judge. Thus, they elect Abimelech to slaughter them all off and be ruler over them. But we'll discuss that next time. Any questions or comments? I'm a little over time. Yes, Richard.
That's required. I think next chapter we'll find out. The reason why they wouldn't let his sons do it because the son would carry out the same judgment that the father did. And they want to go back to Baal worship.
It was a righteous judgment.
They want to go back to Baal worship.
Right. That's true. His sons would have carried out righteous judgment according to the laws of Israel, not laws of Baal. Any questions or comments?
Thank you for your time.